Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guests on this episode are Buick Audra and Jerry Rowe of Friendship Commanders. Their new album, Bear, is out October 10th. It's the group's first for the Magnetic Eye imprint, and the lyrics, as usual, cover a wide range of topics. And Buick Audra and Jerry Rowe discuss the songwriting within Friendship Commanders, their work with the late Steve Albini, who produced their 2018 disc Bill, and much more. That's Jerry Rowe and Buick Audra of Friendship Commanders on Into Music, coming up now. Is this the first time that you've worked with a label on releasing one of the albums?
Yeah, sure is. It's wild. It's a big adjustment.
Yeah, it took a minute to get used to having a third party's ideas and opinions in there, but it's very welcome and kind of relieves pressure and helps a lot, quite honestly. So
that's what I was wondering, because like there's what things like distribution and promotion and stuff like that that a label can help kind of up.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, it's super interesting. You know, we weren't really seeking it out. This record, we made this record on our own, like without any intention of having a label put it out. And another band that we know is on Magnetic Eye and does some social media work, like paid social media work for the label. And yeah, I guess like the label head had asked about Friendship Commanders a couple years ago, and we were notified about that when it happened. And we had just put out Mass though, so we were like not even in the headspace of wondering about what would happen next. And, you know, it came around this time, like maybe before Bear was even mastered, I think our friend over at the label was like, hey, are you interested in being introduced or whatever? And we were introduced. And yeah, we got offered a deal like that right after they heard the record, And it was interesting because the initial email had been sort of like, yeah, there's a lot going on. I got a lot happening on my plate, but I'm always open to hearing new things, you know, that kind of those brush off emails we've all received by the hundreds. And then the next email we got, they wanted the record, which felt very encouraging, I think.
I'll add that it was actually, there was a big space between those emails, and we found out that was because he'd been listening to the record the whole time, essentially, which was wild to hear.
Yeah, and had very detailed questions and comments and all sorts of things. It was cool. It was, I think as an independent band or musician, you get very used to the idea that no one cares at all and that you have to care, you know, the most. And that remains true, but it was really interesting to have such an enthusiastic response from a label too, that like many of our friends and peers are on. I think we've gotten really used to the idea of being very separate, very different, and that we were always just going to put out our own work. So it's very nice to be included and to be wanted. And we're super proud of the record. So we were glad that somebody else heard what we heard before. I mean, it was literally the first outside person that heard it, other than like the team who had like mixed and mastered it, who always work on our stuff, you know, Baloo and Boatwright.
Cool. Yeah. Well, and I think there's a thing too that happens when you're on a label, right? Because there's, with websites and everything, then somebody's looking for, you know, one band and they see, oh, this other band's on there. What are they like?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There's a family that people are coming to check out, as opposed to, I mean, I grew up listening to groups of bands that were on sort of like post-hardcore labels like Discord, and it was very much that kind of thing. You were like, well, if Discord's putting them out, they're probably mostly good, you know. That was the going idea, you know, even though that had like a regional sort of specificity to it as a roster, but it remained true that everyone you listened to on Discord had something interesting going on that you wanted to check out.
Buick, you did the Adult Child album earlier this year, and then this record. So What kind of is like the line between a friendship commander song and a solo song for you?
They mostly have nothing to do with each other in my mind. It's like they sort of land themselves in one project or the other when I write them. There have been a couple of exceptions to that statement, but there's a song on Adult Child called Birthdays and Bullshit that the first time I played for Jerry, he wanted it to be a Friendship Commander song, and I said no, just because the subject matter and just something about its tonality, even though it's heavy, and it is the heaviest song on that collection. That song is about the stripes that I have from being raised in a very specific type of family. And part of that is the friendships that I drew to me for a very long time. And so Birthdays and Bullshit is about the sort of tail end of that chapter of friendships, the people that had with whom I had similar dynamics to my family, you know. So it belonged on there. But and there was also a solo song called July's Revelations that Jerry did convince me to make a Friendship Commander song. But
You know,
normally, no.
I'll add that Birthdays and Bullshit, it was always obviously a Buick solo song. I just had a very strong emotional response to it when she played it.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I never really quite know exactly what the next Friendship Commander's record's going to sound like anyway. So I was
Yeah.
like, is this it?
Yeah,
Yeah,
that's true.
July's Revelations, it did weirdly fit in that body of work. And I also think that sometimes we could have a lower key song. It can be cool.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm always open to what Jerry thinks because he participates in, I mean, he is half of Friendship Commanders. And then, you know, in my solo stuff, he's present some of the time. On Adult Child, the band is actually not present all of the time. But yeah, I'm, you know, obviously he's like one of my primary and favorite collaborators and people. So I'm open to whatever. But the songs kind of find themselves to either project. I don't do much of that assigning.
So, are there still discussions though? Like, I mean, does not to put you on the spot, Jerry, but does Jerry have any sort of like veto?
Oh God, yes. Yeah. Not in Buick Odra. Too bad in that project, but in Friendship
I mean, I don't
Commander.
use it often, and I actually don't remember it happening in Bear. It probably did. Did it?
I don't think it happened on Bear, but I think I probably wrote three or four songs in the Mass season that are not on Mass, that didn't get recorded at all,
Yeah,
where
and
Jerry was like, I don't think so.
what I remember of them, they really do not fit the body of work that ended up coming out.
Yeah, and they're not anywhere. Those are songs that I will later demo and just like archive somewhere so that all my songs exist in some form or another. But yeah, they didn't get recorded at all. Yeah, Jerry totally has veto power. And Jerry has like, I think, the strongest sense of objectivity. I think all of my songs are bad most of the time. So Jerry is better able. I'm serious. Jerry is better able to, if I play him something for Friendship Commanders and I'm like, it probably sucks, but I'm going to play it for you one time. He'll be like, this is the best song you've written this year, you know? And he has a better sense of what is powerful and is not strong enough or whatever. I'm not usually the best gauge of that. I have a different relationship with it.
Jerry, I'm curious because you mentioned having an emotional response to a song, and I wonder if, like, when you're creating parts, for instance, for the tunes, are you trying to maybe sometimes channel some of that emotional energy that you're experiencing, the way that you experience the song, into your playing?
So, you know, what's tough about that, and this has been a problem with me trying to talk about how I approach music to begin with, maybe Buick can back me up with this. I don't really think, I've not ever really thought that much about stuff. I think there are gears turning, and sometimes I'll be like, it's if I'm thinking, I'm mostly acknowledging external pressures or like ideas about like the community that we're in, and like, you know, you do have to think about that sometimes and be like, our metal crowd wants some flash here. We probably got to do that. But otherwise, I'm not really, I'm just playing and it's happening and it's going. And you know, with Mass especially, I think for some reason with the Mass body of work, I didn't really have a lot of time to come up with parts. So most of that stuff was off the cuff. I play those songs very different now than we did on the record. And I don't think it's necessarily better or worse. Like the parts that are on the record are great. It's just how it came together. We rehearsed the hell out of Bear and we stretched the songs out as far as they could go. So there was a lot more thought and preparation put into those parts, I feel like. So that it is kind of the first record we've done that on. necessarily. I don't think that's going to become a standard. Like next record could be completely different. It probably will be. So that is a really long-winded way of saying I don't really think much. I do just play from emotion, and I really respond to Buick songwriting and always have, essentially.
Yeah. You'll sometimes lead the discussion on like, I tend to be like very loud all the time. I want everything to be very forward-leaning. And Jerry sometimes will lead a conversation about bringing things down dynamically in certain places more than I would do on my own. I think you're more like that than I am. I'm much more throttling, which is funny because I think we have the opposite. I think it's gendered. I think people assume because I'm a woman that I'm the reason that there's like sugar on this record. It's
Well, and
not.
that is a very stereotypical way to think of a drummer.
I think that's always the best answer is that the more I talk to people, the more you ask them about how'd you make that choice, it's usually I have no idea.
Well, and you know, it's funny. Usually I'll just like play a random fill into the first chorus. I'm like, okay, that's the theme of the song. So I'll just play like the more progressed, bigger version of that fill. And then I have to get the biggest one in towards the end of the song. And that's about as far as it goes, honestly.
I
So.
think on Bear in general, with the performances on guitar and drums, and then certainly vocals, which is like a whole other conversation, I think we pushed ourselves the hardest we've ever pushed a body of work. We wanted this, it's a maximalist album for us, I think, all around. I think we really went for it more than, I think Mass was much more sort of like first blush, like visceral, and Bear's definitely a little bit more like throttled in
You
every
know,
direction.
the thing I've never really put into words or even kind of understood into this point was that Mass was a pandemic conceived project.
It was.
Whereas with like The Enemy, I know we played that song for a year and a half leading up to recording it. We did the same with Keeping Score on Bear. So not being in the throes of the pandemic kind of allowed us to prepare more. And I think that is probably why Mass was so like, it wasn't rushed. It was just it all happened within a much smaller period of time.
I wrote that record in the month before we recorded it, just in case you didn't know that, Jed. That record was like written right before we tracked it. It was brand new to both of us, and a lot of Bear was as well, but we still had more time to prepare.
Amazing. So let's talk about some of the lyrical themes, if we can. So this time you're dealing with broadly the idea of being an outsider or outsiders and the kind of sometimes probably intentional and other times probably sort of subconscious gatekeeping that goes on in the world, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess so. That's sort of just what emerged. Again, like I don't spend a lot of time being like, I don't think I've ever been like, I'm going to write a body of work about this or I'm going to write a song about this. But the season of life that I found myself in and that I still find myself in to some extent, when Bear was coming together is one where I was like, oh, I am like not doing this correctly by the standards of my peers. And I started to kind of explore where that started, and it was like from the jump, truly. I mean, Keeping Score is written about this set of experiences that I had as a kid, like a kid with the mother of my best friend, who, my best friend was a boy growing up. I was a skater, and his mother just terrorized me. I mean, she just thought that I was trash, and she also thought that I was like sexually exploiting her kid and all the boys around us. I mean, I was 13, I was like an actual child, and listeners may know from past episodes that I was kicked out at 13 and moved all over Hell's Hatbaker and raised by assorted weirdos. And so it was already tough enough. And it really was like this brutal thing that was happening in the sidelines of my life. And that has in many cases like been true my whole life, like where women have been really freaked out by me or been like, you're outside of what I need around my child. Female friends of mine's mothers behaved that way toward me. And it just continues to this day. And so when I wrote Keeping Score, I was like, okay, something is emerging here. I'm starting to talk about this. And then I just got honest about like the way it is to be a woman in music, to have other women competing with me constantly and not trusting me. And it's just a, It's been a lonely life with other women, like deeply lonely. And I'm not supposed to say that. And I understand I'm not supposed to say it. Like, it's been made, not one woman has spoken to me about this record, you know? And we're four singles in. No women want to talk to me about this. So I understand I'm doing something wrong again, but it remains true, you know, that I am very on the outside of womanhood. I think I always have been. And I wanted to look at that in these songs as how it factors into like what's going on in the world right now, which is that I think that there is a lot of looking at certain groups of people and their tendencies and being like, that's why this is weird. But I don't think anyone wants to look at ourselves and the groups that we belong to and be like, what's going on over here, you know, in this chapter, and who's centering who and who's punishing who for existing. So the record ended up being about that, and the album is called Bear because bear has several meanings, one of which is to carry, one of which is to press down, and one of which is to, you know, have a kid. And those are all things that I've been expected to do as a woman by other women, and I'm
It's
not doing any of them well. I know.
It's so funny because I can think about friends or relationships I've had with women who have had daughters, and sometimes I feel like the women are so much harder on the daughters than they are the sons.
It's a long life. I mean, it's been yeah, it's been deeply lonely. And I think that I have to be careful where it's important for me to make cultural work through my personal experience, right? So like I can't cast such a broad net that I'm including all women or even all white women. I understand that like there are cultural pockets that are not behaving this way. My lived experience is that I am on the outside. I've been on the outside steadily. No women are speaking to me now, you know. So it's I'm speaking from the I me, you know, but can you ever be the only one? I mean, I just don't know. I just don't think so, you know. And when we put Keeping Score out, it turned out that lots of people had experienced that growing up, that a lot of girls were terrorized by grown women. I find it frightening. I find it frightening and problematic because what's also true is that those same women will turn around and expect the labor of this world, the labor of the activism, the labor of the feminist movement to be done by me, not by you and Jerry, by me. So they want to box me out. They want to compete with me. They want to call me all sorts of weird stuff. And then they want me to work. And I think that that is pick one. If I'm going to be outside, then leave me alone. If I'm going to be working for your team, what's going on? But you can't have both. That's my statement.
Right on. Yeah. You also in X, there's a line in there that I absolutely love about, you know, goodbye, I'm probably gonna mess up the order. Goodbye, Hope, goodbye, Steve. You both died in early May. Do I have that order right?
Goodbye, Steve, and goodbye, Faith. They died together in early May. Yeah.
And I like that there was like, okay, so Faith could be a person, right? But I don't think that's how you're referencing it, but in the line, there's that slight ambiguity to it. And I was like, oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, you know, I felt such a sense of belonging with Steve, and I have felt such a sense of belonging with pockets of Gen X my whole life. And watching Gen X grieve Steve was really singular because it is such a stoic bracket of people, and the grief style tends to be very individual. You know, people grieve like it happened to them personally and not like it happened to everybody. And certainly that it happened to Steve's nearest and dearest. And so it was just an interesting time to watch that happen. And I do think that something was lost when Steve died, that a certain amount of like a fire went out somewhere, for sure.
You worked with him on the album Bill, right?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear from both of you on any memories that you have of that experience or anything that really stood out to you from that time.
Jerry, you go.
Oh man, I'm bad at this when I'm on the spot.
It's like when people ask you what your favorite song is and you can't think of a song you've heard of in your life on earth. You're like, the 12 Days of Christmas.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole experience was just slightly surreal while also being incredibly easy. It was immediately comfortable, and it was you were working with Steve Albini, but at the same time you were just working with an engineer that you had a good rapport with, and that was kind of it at the end of the day. Yeah, you know, I guess it's a weird memory that only a drummer would lock into. When we were getting sounds, he liked to hear single drums first instead of the whole drum kit. And that is a way of doing things that is not as common, but it was just like, I don't know. Just that's when I started to really like take note of his process, and that's when it became real that I was working with him, you know.
Yeah. Steve was so cool because, you know, for the last 30 years of his life, he was probably the most famous, most sort of infamous recording engineer of his time. And when we walked in, and we had emailed with him leading up, you know, about making the record or whatever. But when we walked in, he just turned around from his board and said, "Hi, I'm Steve." And I thought that was kind of great. You know, Steve, he didn't have any airs and he didn't have any, there was a profound absence of ego, I thought. And I really was not looking forward to working with him because he was my favorite engineer. And I thought, like, what if he's a nightmare? You know, all these people had been like, he's a nightmare in interviews about him or whatever. And he was lovely. He was super funny, super dry, sharp as shit, like just a really had a biting, dark sense of humor. And I feel like when we were tracking guitars and drums, which were tracked live together on the same floor with Jerry and I were separated by sliding glass doors, but those performances are actually captured together. And Steve was up in his lofted control room. You know, that was all like kind of mechanical. And I feel like that was kind of a sweaty time where we were just like, okay, we're tracking to tape and we're tracking with Steve. And it felt like kind of a big deal. But as soon as we started tracking vocals, Steve really softened and got very interested and very involved and became very producery. And my favorite, maybe not my favorite, but one of my favorite memories of working with Steve was tracking vocals for a song called What You Ravage. And, you know, Steve had all of these sort of singular miking techniques and ways that he thought about capturing sound. So I was singing down in the live room where the drums had been, the huge room in Studio B, where Steve literally raised the ceiling of that, the roof of that building, so that the ceiling could be as high as it is. And so I was singing and he was sort of messing around with things on his end. And he said, "I want you to come up here and listen back to this. I think that you'll be pleased." And I came up and he pulled up things a certain way on his board. And what he had done was mic the floor in the room. And he had pulled up all the floor mics to hear all of the vibration of my voice. There's no reverb on that vocal. It's just the way that he had mic'd his room. And I cried. And it was like the only time I cried during the process of making that record. I'm not in the habit of bursting into tears, but I did cry because it was both beautiful, but it was also thoughtful. Like Steve was sitting there being like, "She's gonna like this. And I'm gonna, you know, pull this up in such a way that it makes her understand what we're doing." And it was really powerful.
Wow, that's amazing. And I think too, when I realized how good he was, I was listening to a Robbie Foulkes album, right? And
Yeah.
it's just like acoustic guitar and vocals. And I'm like, oh my God, that's like the best acoustic guitar and vocals I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He had such a broad range of recordings under his belt, so many different types of genre. I mean, many Christian artists recorded with Steve. You know, he's thought of as being this certain type of musician and certain type of engineer, but and in many ways he was, but he worked with a lot of different kinds of people on a huge variety of recordings. Super cool, incredible legacy, and just was a great dude. And I think the people he didn't like probably deserved it.
Let's talk about too one of the things that I love on this record, which is the sequencing. So what kind of process is that like for the two of you to like sequence an album? Is it a lot of like listen in the car, make eight different lists of running orders?
Sequences were always easy and mostly driven by Buick. This record, though, was different. It went through a lot of mutations, and the one that's out now is like kind of a team effort compromise almost.
Yeah, I feel
It
like that
was,
was the fifth sequence we landed on.
yeah.
Originally, the record was supposed to start with Melt, and the guy running our label, that was his only request, that it not start with Melt. He thought that ha ha at the beginning of that song would be too soft for the heavies. And I don't think I'm going to go to jail for saying this. And And we were like, you're wrong. But he was like, maybe, but can we just have this one compromise? We were like, Arr! So he really wanted the record to start with Keeping Score, which is the mother of the album, which was the first song written for the collection. And that made a certain kind of sense to me. It didn't feel wrong, but we had to really get our minds around what that would mean instead. And we wanted the relationship between the rest of the songs that were moving to be like natural, but also like to have a power to it, you know, that like you would end one song that made you feel a certain way, and then something else would sort of grab a hold of you and like pick you back up. So I'm glad if that feels like that happened. And then the mastering was done really beautifully by Brad Boatwright, who's been working on our stuff for about 6 years now. And I said to Jerry, when we landed on this final sequence, I said, I want this to feel like Redman's new record. I want it to feel like a hip hop album, because hip hop doesn't give a shit. Those tracks are just slammed into each other. They don't give any breathing time. There's no, you know, it's like could just be one slab.
The endings and starts are weird and sudden,
I
and it's
know.
great.
I know. Yeah. So, I mean, I think we might have even said that to Brad, like, check out Redman's Muddy Waters 2 or whatever we had said. But it that was really the inspiration around the record, sort of not breathing too much, but just feeling like it was really cohesive and connected in the mastering.
It was funny because thinking about the song X and the idea of Gen X. With Found and Dead and Discarded Girls, listening to those in that order, I really tapped into my Gen X self because I was like, okay, the volume has to come up on.
Yeah, Dead and Discarded Girls should really beat the shit out of you, I think, if we're doing our job. Like the way that those transitions happen should be really abrupt. I'm very proud of that. Was like two different setups completely for the quiet and loud parts of that song, you know, to make it have that kind of impact. We really wanted it to be quite stark.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not. I don't listen to music very loud, but I made an exception for this record. So,
Thank
it's really hard not to with our stuff. I feel like it ends up. It is both exhausting and really satisfying. It's exhausting,
I
I mean,
feel
by
like
the ears getting worn out.
that third track, Dripping Silver, also wants a loud volume. Like when that riff kicks in, I'm always like, yeah. Like even I turn it up, and I wrote the song, you know, and I can be, I sometimes have a hard time listening to my own work, but I have listened to this record a bunch, and I always want that song to be loud.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a conversation with Jerry Rowe and Buick Audra of Friendship Commanders. The duo's new album, Bear, is out October 10th via the Magnetic Eye label. You can learn more about the band, including seeing tour dates, at friendshipcommandersband.com. You can learn more about Buick Audra at buickaudra.com and Jerry Rowe via jerryrowemusic.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and as always, this is a great time to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. We'll see you next time.